All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome. I will say hello to each person, starting with Ellen and Marv, Richard, Sydney, James, Pat, Soon, Sam, Mark W, Bob, Jim, Yashetsoki, Dinajria,
but yes, you got
Dinajria. Oh, that's beautiful. Dinajria. Hi. Tyler, Mary, John, Choketsu, Bonnie, Vin, Paulette, Jessica, Colleen, and Amelia.
Good morning.
We've had quite a changeover. There was a bunch of people here for meditation, and now they're not here. And now you have a whole bunch of people. Pretty impressive. And people from all over the United States. It's pretty neat. Let's see. In terms of announcements, the fall term student program will be starting on September 12th. That is it lasts until there's an opening retreat on September 12th, the closing retreat on December 19th. So it's about 3 months long. And it's about focusing your practice for that period of time. So you come up with personal vows for that amount of time, and you know how much you're going to sit, if you're going to read anything, focus on anything, then you can add that into your vows. And it's, you know, personally tailored to what your aspirations are, what you're able to do. And what we do is the people who sign up for the program, you know, you form a cohort over that period of time, and we do a little bit of check-ins. We, at the opening retreat, we get to know each other better, share our life stories. In the closing retreat, we reflect on the term together. We're aware of each other's vows. And in between, we check in a little bit by email. And there's also a couple one-day retreats in the middle that are recommended but not required for the program. So if you are, there's information on the website, the top menu says term student. If you, and you also hopefully will be signed up for our weekly newsletter. If you're not, then you can go to the website and do that. But the weekly newsletter also points out these kinds of things that are happening that you might be interested in. Another piece is we're trying to arrange a picnic that would happen in the same place as where we had Jukai, and nice socially distanced picnic. So there's a little poll that we created with some suggested times, and we want to see if there's any time that works for a bunch of people who are interested. That went out by the Sangha email list. So try to check that. We'll try to send it out again. But just be heads up. I mean, or if anybody is on a computer where they can easily go find that link through their email and you can drop it in the chat, that would be lovely. Anything else that anyone can think of that we should mention? All right. So today's talk, I'm calling Respect Even for Terrible People. What does it mean? So Buddhism, like probably most major religions, teach that we should treat each and every human being, or maybe all beings, but particularly human beings, with respect, regardless of their behavior, regardless of their appearance, regardless of their off-putting manifestation. And what does this really mean? Sometimes people are hateful and willfully ignorant, manipulative, cruel, selfish, irresponsible. Sometimes people are downright violent and destructive. So in being asked to respect such people, I mean, surely we're not being asked to ignore or condone their behavior. So what does respect actually mean? What does it actually look like? And why is it important to cultivate respect in this way? So my encounter with this recently has been, I'm part of the Extinction Rebellion movement, and one of our principles and values is we respect everyone. So it's a strictly nonviolent movement, and we respect everyone and every part of everyone. And, you know, sometimes that's a difficult thing. It's like if you are trying to peacefully demonstrate and the cops are getting in your face and being brutal, what does it mean to respect the cops in that situation? So sometimes we get pushback from people like, I don't know about this respect people in every situation or respect everyone. So it's worth exploring. So just for the sake of argument today, I'm going to say, let's say there are terrible people. Now, part of our practice is humility, is recognizing, you know, we have our view, other people have their view, they're just as attached to their view as we are to our view. We're sure we are right and the other side is wrong. I'm certain of that. They feel the same way. Now, it's a very rare person who might find themselves acting in a really violent, criminal, deceptive way, in a way that they kind of strangely can't help somehow, and they recognize that they are a terrible person, if you will. But that's relatively rare. Most people who are doing harm don't think that they're doing anything wrong. Most people think of themselves as a good person, or as at least they're trying their best to be a good person. So, and, you know, and then we get to that ideal in a way, right, of calling out or condemning behaviors, but not the people. So it's really, you know, it's not really right to say there are terrible people. But for the sake of today's argument, let's just say there are. Let's say, you know, people who rarely think beyond their own safety, comfort, and profit. People who think nothing of hurting others for their own advantage or amusement. People with greedy or ambitious agendas who feel justified in whatever destruction it takes to keep their grip on power. People who sow division and stoke fears in order to tighten their grip on power so they can look out for their own self-interests. So call to mind these kinds of people. And what does it mean that we're asked to respect even such people? So many of us are current or former Christians. So I figured I'd start off with a bit from Jesus in Matthew 43-48. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. And then there's, of course, another line. So whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. So to go to our Buddhist teachings, this is a story from the Lotus Sutra. So another Lotus Sutra parable. So the Buddha's describing, during a period of the merely formal Dharma, this is a tale from the past, extremely arrogant monks had great power. At that time, there was a Bodhisattva monk named Never Disrespectful. Why do you think he was named Never Disrespectful? That monk bowed in obeisance before everyone he met, whether monk, nun, layman, or laywoman, and praised them, saying, I deeply respect you. I would never dare to be disrespectful or arrogant toward you. Why? Because all of you are practicing the Bodhisattva way and will surely become Buddhas. This monk did not devote himself to reading and reciting sutras, but simply went around bowing to people. If he saw the four groups off in the distance, he would make a point of going up to them, bowing in obeisance and praising them, saying, I would never dare to disrespect you, because surely you are all to become Buddhas. Among the four groups were those who became angry, enraged, and mean-spirited, and reviled and cursed him, saying, this ignorant monk who takes it on himself to announce that he does not respect us and assures us of becoming Buddhas, where did he come from? We have no use for such empty, false assurances. Thus he passed many years, constantly being cursed, but never becoming angry or enraged, and always saying, surely you are to become Buddhas. When he spoke this way, some would hit him with sticks, tiles, or stones. But even if he ran off and stood at a distance, he would continue to cry out loudly, I would not dare to disrespect you. Surely all of you are to become Buddhas. And because he always spoke in this way, the extremely arrogant monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen called him Never Disrespectful. When this monk was nearing death, from the sky he heard 200 million billion verses of the Dharma Flower Sutra, and he was able to receive and embrace them all. Immediately he obtained the purity of vision and the faculties of ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind described earlier. Having obtained the purity of these six faculties, his life was extended for 2 million billion myriads of years, and he taught this Dharma Flower Sutra everywhere for all people. Then the extremely arrogant monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen, who had slighted and shown contempt for this man and given him the name Never Disrespectful, seeing him with the power of great divine faculties, powers of joyful and eloquent speech, and the powers of great goodness and tranquility, having heard him preached, all believed in him and followed him. So, what does respect really mean? So, the dictionary definition: esteem for, or a sense of the worth or excellence of a person, a personal quality or ability, or something considered as a manifestation of a personal quality or ability. So clearly we are not, when we're talking about our terrible person, we're not respecting a person's behavior or particular unskillful, arrogant manifestation. That just doesn't make any sense. So I'm not respecting your brutality. I'm not respecting your selfishness. That's that's an oxymoron, right? We cannot respect someone's small-mindedness, selfishness, greed, harmful behavior, unwillingness or inability to take responsibility for themselves. I mean, we might be able to summon some compassion for those things, kind of sympathizing with imagining how did this person end up like that? Perhaps they're suffering or in pain or scared, and that's why they're acting this way. So we might be able to summon some compassion for those things, but it's not a matter of respect for those manifestations. So what does it mean to have unconditional respect for, well, you know, we can say a terrible person to make it really simple. What does it mean to have respect for someone who you really just feel is doing something very, very wrong? So I figured we would do a short breakout in order to discuss this, share ideas. So what does it mean to have this unconditional respect for someone, even when you can't respect what they're doing or saying or the way they're being? So I'll just give you 10 minutes and you get an invite.
Happened. Where they ended up.
Yeah, weird. There's still like a couple people in the rooms. Did I like close them and open them again? Weird.
Also, I'm sorry for being in and out, but I have to go up and down
right
for the people upstairs, so I should probably just block out my video.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Yeah, I find when I get in a big room, sometimes it freezes up a little bit, so I just save the video part. So sorry for this. Is Amelia, by the way.
You're showing us lovely flowers.
So. Thank you.
All right. Well, I'm guessing those were pretty juicy conversations. So I continue to explore what is this respect that we are aiming for? So especially in Buddhism, we often talk about this respect being for someone's Buddha nature, someone's potential for awakening. So maybe right now they're not doing so well, but what we respect is this potential that they have the same essential nature we do, and they could learn and grow and transform. So for instance, in the Lotus Sutra story, you know, the Bodhisattva, never disrespectful, attains purity of vision and great powers, and then the monks and the people, monks, nuns, and lay people who reviled him, then converted. So in the end, they did have the capacity for change. And, you know, real life, it doesn't happen that often. People are pretty stubborn, but real life does contain some examples, you know, the kind of classic one about, you know, the people are formerly involved in hate groups, and then they kind of wake up and get converted and speak out against such groups. So, but most of the time people are quite stubborn. How do we get people to change their minds, even about small things? You know, there's a reason the Lotus Sutra called these folks, quote unquote, extremely arrogant. And what about it when somebody really doesn't seem to have the capacity for change? They seem utterly unrepentant, unsympathetic, eager to continue in their ignorance and hatefulness. In our group, we were talking about the kind of, you know, people who just seem to enjoy just getting a rise out of people, just poking people and provoking people. So somebody's extremely likely to improve, let alone transform and awaken in this lifetime. And maybe this is why we have that Buddhist imagery of multiple lifetimes, which, you know, I don't literally believe in, but that imagery suggests that we are reborn, that some aspect of us is reborn, and so maybe this person is not going to achieve much in this lifetime, but then they have future lifetimes to work on it. And I like that imagery. It's a useful metaphor, because if you think about a hateful person being respected, like the Bodhisattva, never respectful, I respect you no matter what. And you imagine that hateful person dying, and the karmic causes that go forward, even if you're not literally thinking about this person being reborn, the people that person knows, the community around that person, you know, once that person dies, what, there's still causes and conditions that continue. And if you've treated this person with respect, those karmic causes are going to be quite different than if you fought with a person and reviled them and attacked them. You know, then one thing I could imagine is that person's children or community might be even further entrenched against you, you know, and then you kind of just continue a cycle of hatred from generation to generation. So we do have this idea of, like, that there is this potential for awakening in anyone, even if it might take multiple lifetimes. But at a deeper level, I would say that that respect still has a meaning and a value apart from any hope about the future. Any hope about this individual's future or the world's future. That has a meaning and a value in this moment. You know, I think about manifesting kindness and compassion toward all beings, you know, even animals. In this moment, we know that this person, at least in some respects, is like us. They have fears and desires. They want to be right. They hope for security and happiness. Sometimes they might be funny or gentle or generous with certain people. All they want is happiness, even if they have really screwed up ideas about what happiness is and how to get it. Deep down, they want to be accepted and loved, at least by people that they respect. They eat and sleep and get sick and feel pain and pleasure. So no matter how unskillful or selfish or harmful the person's behavior, no matter how pathetic or repulsive their manifestation, at the end of the day, they are a being who will be negatively impacted if we are cruel. And at some level, probably touched if we are kind and respectful. So a truly arrogant person, of course, will probably deny being hurt by your disrespect, or they'll get defensive or lash out. But really, these responses actually only prove that they're hurt. And I would say that no matter what the other side is up to, the kind of language being used to describe the other side in our country right now, no matter which side you're talking about, is profoundly disrespectful. It's just, we were talking in our breakout group about when you're face to face with someone, it's more difficult to hate them. You can see what I was just talking about. You can see at some level they're like you. At some level they have, you know, experience pleasure and pain and doubt, and that you can see that they're kind of like you. But the further away people get from us, the easier it is just to, or the harder it is to feel respect despite what they're doing, and the harder it is to have that sense of their humanity. So I think that's very much what our country and our world is like right now. We're intimately tied, our well-being is intimately tied to so millions of people around the world in our own country. So we affect one another, but we're not proximate to one another. We can't see one another. We don't know one another. So it's much easier to feel that disrespect, and to some of the things that we say about groups of people or about people from afar, you know, if you overheard someone using that same language face to face, you'd be like, oh my God, that's so hateful and violent. I mean, I and my friends and my family, you know, we do this too. And it's true that an arrogant person will probably get defensive or lash out even if you treat them with respect. Just as the arrogant people in the Lotus Sutra, right? They're like, how dare you say you don't respect us? They threw stones and tiles at this bodhisattva. Jesus spoke only for love. He was crucified. Those who did the nonviolent demonstrations for civil rights in the 60s were attacked with dogs and fire hoses. Like, so, you know, responding with respect is no guarantee of good treatment. But at least in those cases, the arrogant are harming themselves. You are not harming them. So I don't know how many of you heard this wonderful speech by Michelle Obama at the Democratic National Convention last week, but it's just incredibly touching. And she referenced something she said 4 years ago, where she says, when they go low, we go high. So she said this time, I know that regardless of our race, age, religion, or politics, when we close out the noise and the fear and truly open our hearts, we know that what's going on in this country is just not right. This is not who we want to be. So what do we do now? What's our strategy? Over the past 4 years, a lot of people have asked me, when others are going so low, does going high still really work? My answer, going high is the only thing that works. Because when we go low, when we use those same tactics of degrading and dehumanizing others, we just become part of the ugly noise that's drowning out everything else. We degrade ourselves. We degrade the very causes for which we fight. So what does unconditional respect actually look like? I'm sure there's many different ways this can be described. I'm going to share a list, and then, you know, if you have any thoughts, I'll pause and share. But I was thinking firm but kind, you know, like a parent who's correcting a wayward child. Firm, drawing boundaries, but with an underlying kindness. Taking a stand against behaviors and situations and systems, but not focusing on blaming and shaming individuals. Clear, truthful speech. Sometimes even expressing anger and outrage, but also refraining from attacks, refraining from generalizations about groups of people, about assigning blame. I was really struck by how, you know, Michelle Obama was criticizing Trump's response to the coronavirus, but she refrained, unlike so many other politicians and folks, she refrained from blaming the coronavirus on Trump. She just said his response was not up to the task. So, I mean, there was a real thoughtfulness there where instead of just attacking and like blaming him for 180,000 deaths, I mean, that's not, it's not directly his fault. Maintaining some faith and hope that people can change, that they have some measure of compassion and empathy and generosity for their fellow beings, even if it's deeply buried. And sometimes this is how it can be helpful to, it can be helpful to learn more about people, to hear from them. Like on that, I forget the name of the woman who was like traveling around doing a TV show, and she would go visit people in all kinds of different areas of the country, totally different political stripes, and just kind of hang out with them and get to know them. Sarah Silverman. And because a lot of times what we're looking at is people, they don't seem to have as universal a set of values as we do, or we would like people to think about the well-being of others and the well-being of the poor or et cetera. But, and you know, we can still ask for that, but almost everybody does have at least a sphere of people for whom they demonstrate kindness and care and generosity. It may only be for their own children. It may only be for people in some particular club, but they have some of it, which means it's there, right? That possibility is there. Going high even when others go low, recognizing when judgment, disgust, hatred toward others arises in us, which they're going to, and being mindful of it and taking responsibility for it. In a way, not judging ourselves either, it's just something that's arising, but taking responsibility for it instead of, like I think most people do, frankly, is taking that as a sign that we're right. I feel outrage and hatred. Therefore, those people are worth my hatred. When it's that, that's just a thought and a feeling that's arising in us. We take responsibility for it and not take it as truth or just unleash it. And I guess this was, since this one was a little, I don't know, it's obvious and subtle, not killing others, literally, but obviously for most of us, we're talking about figuratively. So killing is like, it's, we want to cut it out. We want to reject it. We want to undo it, trying to cut them out of our reality. But unfortunately, no matter how terrible people are, that doesn't work. We can't undo their existence with our mind. Here they are. Here they are, and we either have to find a way to work with them or we're not going to get anything done. So I'll open it up there. If anybody has any other thoughts about, you know, what does this kind of respect actually look like? How does it actually manifest? Just go ahead and unmute yourself if you have something to say.
Well, it just occurred to me, I'd say Judeo-Christian society in general has this good versus evil kind of dichotomy. And a lot of cultures, a lot of, you know, societies have this basic good versus evil, punishment for wrongdoing, you know. And Buddhism has an enlightenment versus delusion model. And that respects the mirror upon which enlightenment or delusion is reflected, in my mind. So, you know, people aren't like a lot of, you know, people who, like you said, you know, people think they think they're doing the right thing. You know, I've often said if I thought that hair had feelings, I might go protest the barbershop. You know, it would be a completely deluded thing to do, but if I really felt that way, then I might do that. You know, so It's enlightenment versus delusion. There are a lot of people. There are some people that are just plain, you know, I don't know if they're Ichentikas or they can't, they're, can you reach these people? But most people that I disagree with and I find vile in some way, or, you know, expressing vile opinions, they're just wrong. They're just really, really, really wrong. And a lot of these people have nobody, there's nobody around to tell them they're wrong. There's nobody around, they're in a bubble, and there's no one willing to even discuss their wrongness with them.
Thank you. Can you hear me? I have a fan going.
We don't hear it.
Yes. Oh, okay, cool. I'm thinking about this, and I'm feeling the word ego, you know, just it keeps kind of rolling around in my brain, and in terms of letting my ego get in the way, and then also letting go of it, as far as if I can find a way to have respect, like we were talking in our breakout session, for just the humanity of that being, and keep it that simple, and then I may completely really have almost, you know, hatred for what they've done, especially if it's really heinous, obviously, but if I can find a way, and for myself, it's really for myself, to have that respect of what I say it is in my own being. That other person doesn't even have to understand it. In fact, I don't even care if they get it. But if I can figure out a way to do that, I guess I feel like it frees me, and it empowers me in a positive way, not in a dominating way, but in a freeing positive way. And it's not easy. In fact, it's really hard when I think about it. But as I'm looking at your list, and I really appreciate that list. That list is awesome. In fact, I wrote it down. I feel like a lot of those things really are that detachment, you know, that healthy, respectful detachment. And it's given me a lot to think about. So anyway, that's my that's my thought for the moment. Thanks.
I like that. I think that's a good point. I'm imagining I'm not alone in feeling like some of the feelings that arise when I hear about somebody's speech, or I find out about someone's behavior or a group of people, and I'm just like, so some of it is my feelings about them, but some of it is like, the kind of needing to be right, or, you know, needing for my argument to win, when it's like, I'm not even face to face with these people. Like, I don't need to have this argument. Other thoughts?
I'll butt in again. I had a friend, I've known him for years. He's from wine country, you know, kind of very insulated. He posted something that was really borderline offensive. And I thought, well, I'll just snooze him. I don't need to, you know. I was like, am I going to unfriend this guy? And instead, I have a friend, Anika Chambers. She gave me this shirt that said, use your privilege, speak up, speak out. So I just kept thinking about that shirt all day yesterday and thinking about him. And finally, I messaged him and I said, this is why your post was offensive. And, you know, and you know, this is where I'm coming from, and just to let him know. He kind of backed off when he replied. He was very respectful when he replied. And I told him, I know you're a good person, and I would not have messaged you otherwise. Mm. So I gave him the respect of telling him he was wrong, because I felt like there's somebody in there that can be reached. Mm. I saw his humanity and reached out to him, and hopefully, I don't know if he deleted that post, but I really hope he did.
Good point.
If I might chime for a second. What helped
Abdullah, will you turn off your video? Turn off your video so we can hear you better. There you go. Go ahead.
Huh. Oh, no.
That's good.
What I was saying was, the way I view it is everybody sees the world through their own paradigms. And those paradigms are empty. I mean, they're just built up, they're conditioned over time. You know, yours is yours, mine is mine.
You might have faded out. Oh, we can't hear you now.
Bummer. Oh, you can't?
You faded out for a while. Now I can hear you again.
What is going on?
It's too bad.
Okay.
You could, I have a suggestion. Abdullah, you could type something in the chat.
It's low bandwidth.
Yeah.
That's a lot of things.
Okay, so that's sorry.
Alright, well. Maybe next time.
Oh. Sorry, I really wanted to hear what you had to say. Alright. Well, so we just have a few minutes left. Let me just close out with a discussion of do we do this for the sake of self or other? And, you know, the answer, of course, is, you know, this maintaining this unconditional respect. And, of course, the answer is both and neither, because you can't really separate them out. So, I mean, when we think about the other, we think about treating people with respect because maybe then we can get through to them, maybe they're more likely to change, you know, but sometimes this can be very difficult because sometimes it just feels like they don't deserve it, right? They do not deserve the kindness, they do not deserve the patience, you know, there can be a concern that our respect might be taken as like condoning or encouraging, you know, so it can be really tricky. But, you know, there's payoffs, like Soon just talked about. There's the classic example of the pro-apartheid prison guard that ended up being really impressed with Mandela. Said, you know, Mandela just brought him around to change his views, and they actually became friends. And afterwards, Mandela visited his family after he was released. But of course, there's the aspect of for ourselves, that the hatred and the anger in our own hearts poisons us. There's a really beautiful poem by Buddhaghosa, 5th century Indian Theravadan monk and scholar. This is from The Path of Purification, or the Visuddhimagga. So suppose an enemy has hurt you now in what is his domain. Why try yourself as well to hurt your mind?
that is not his domain. This anger that you entertain is gnawing at the very roots of all the virtues that you guard. Who is there such a fool as you? Another does ignoble deeds, so you are angry. How is this? Do you want to copy too the sorts of acts he commits? Suppose another to annoy provokes you with some odious act. Why suffer anger to spring up and do as he would have you do? If you get angry, then maybe you make him suffer, maybe not. Though with the hurt that anger brings, you certainly are punished now. If anger-blinded enemies set out to tread the path of woe, do you, by getting angry too, intend to follow heel to toe? Whom shall he hurt who seeks to hurt another in the other's absence? Your presence is the cause of hurt. Why are you angry then with him? And actually, the one of the stanzas I didn't include, I think, was speaking to what Abdullah was saying, was like, things change and pass. What is there that you are now angry with? It can't be grasped. So let me just close with another little paragraph from Michelle Obama's speech. She said, but let's be clear. Going high does not mean putting on a smile and saying nice things when confronted by viciousness and cruelty. Going high means taking the harder path. It means scraping and clawing our way to that mountaintop. Going high means standing fierce against hatred while remembering that we are one nation under God. And if we want to survive, we've got to find a way to live together and work together across our differences. All right, that's it for today. I'll close with a little, our closing verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you.
See you next week.
Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Hey, Chris, where are you?
I'm in Grass Valley, California.
Ah, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, everyone.
And Abdullah, where are you?
Thank you.
Connecticut. Uh-huh. New Britain, Connecticut.
Welcome. Have Thanks. A good day.
All right. You too.
Thank you.